Today on Maine Calling, a history of climate change and climate denial. In the 1800s, scientists first figured out the basics of how carbon emissions would warm the Earth's atmosphere. By the mid-20th century, the science of global warming had hit the mainstream press. In 1953, Time magazine reported on the invisible blanket of greenhouse gases, with much reporting to follow. Given that, why has there been so much confusion among the general public for so long? And why was there so little action from policymakers? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with best-selling author David Lipsky, who sought to answer these questions. He put what he learned into his book, The Parrot and the Igloo. Lipsky follows the story of climate change through the people at its center, from inventors to scientists, to the spin doctors who cleverly sowed doubt. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downey's communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The current wave of science skepticism and climate denial in the U.S. didn't just happen organically. There were people propelling the narrative. Today on Maine Calling, we are going to get to know a few of them. Our guest is best-selling author David Lipsky, who has written a book about climate and the science of denial. It is called The Parrot and the Igloo. David Lipsky is a fiction and nonfiction writer and a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you or someone you know have doubts about climate change? Do you find yourself doubting what the scientific community says in general? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. David Lipsky, welcome to Maine Calling, and thank you so much for joining us. I understand The Parrot and the Igloo has just come out in paperback.
That's quite right. And Jennifer, I did love the public service advisory, if you or someone you love.
I have to ask, and I'm sure that every interview asks you this question, but the name of your book might not be the easiest to remember. How did you come up with the title, The Parrot and the Igloo? What does that symbolize?
It's part of it has to do with why I wrote the book. Elizabeth Hardwick, you know, she and Lowell lived over in Castine. And Elizabeth Hardwick said a great thing about all writing. She said there are only two good reasons to write anything. Can you guess what they are?
No. Go.
Money and revenge. And the revenge part for me on the book was it was a tremendous shock. I was writing a different piece to find out that we knew much of what we know about climate. We knew in the 50s. We really started knowing it in the 1890s, but in the 1950s, it was in Time magazine and it was in the New York Times. In Time magazine, our leading oceanographer said in about 50 years or so, this could have a violent effect on the world's climate. And we didn't take any special action. And in the Times, the same year, the New York Times science section said that when it kicked in, the Arctic regions would be transformed into tropical jungles with tigers roaming the underbrush and gaudy parrots squawking from the trees. So that's kind of where the issue entered the American argument sphere. And then by about 2010, that's the parrot part. And then it's a little bit, did you ever see the third Mad Max? I know we've had our fifth Mad Max this summer, but
I think maybe.
Yeah, it's Thunderdome. And in Thunderdome, two people enter the Thunderdome, one leaves. And that tends to be the way we deal with political issues. We don't deal with them in sort of a weighing them out, like what's the better course of action? Here are the pluses and minuses. It's just like two positions go in and they bash each other. And so climate entered our particular argument sphere in 1956. And in 2010, when it came out, after more than half a century of people fighting over it, in February of 2010, the leading denial senator, a man named James Mountain Inhofe, a senator from Oklahoma, there was a heavy snowfall in D.C. on the Mall, you know, that wonderful long piece of green surrounded by Smithsonians. He and his family built an igloo, and they put two signs on top of it. The first sign said Al Gore's new home. Second sign said, honk if you heart global warming. And so the story is how we turned a parrot into an igloo.
Mm. You know, and we've all seen people like that who write something on social media on a cold, rainy day in June and say, what climate change, you know, so along the same lines. You decided to write the book and tell this story through the people. This book is a series of portraits of inventors, scientists, politicians, spin doctors. And I'm wondering, as I read this, I'm thinking to myself, a lot of this is just psychology, trying to figure out what motivated someone and the psychology of why they did what they did, but why it was received the way it was. And I'm wondering how you decided, why you decided to approach this in this way.
Jennifer, I've been talking about the book basically for a year, and that's the first time someone asked that question. And it's one I prepared for a year ago in hardback. And now my brain has softened by the time we've gotten to the softback version. It's people did it. And the stories themselves, it was fascinating to me. Why would a kind of person go into denial? And I think we know it socially. Generally, we can all agree that ice cream is great, or that summer, you know, before recently, that summer is more fun than winter. And then there will always be one person who's like, no, I hate summer, or ice cream is a terrible dessert. And then you say, what dessert do you like? And they say, peach pits. I like to cut a peach open and just suck on the pit. And it's kind of a way to get attention. And that was sort of what happened with the deniers. It was super interesting to try to figure out if there was a kind of personality type that would lead to somebody disagreeing with what 97% of people who are experts in the field have said is the case. And so, of course, you had to tell the personalities. And the second thing is, we tend to act as if this is something that just happened to us. Either politicians foisted it on us, or corporations foisted it. Someone is doing, some faceless thing is doing the foisting. And the reality is, it is just the result of a number of, let's say, two-thirds well-meaning choices, and then one-third mustache-twirling dastardly forces. And so I thought, to really help us understand the issue, you had to see the people who had made both pleasant decisions and awful decisions, and finally nefarious decisions about global warming.
Why did you go all the way back to inventors? Why are we all the way back at Thomas Edison at the beginning of the book?
Because if you're hearing this broadcast and you're driving and you're charging your phone, let's say you have a portable battery and you're charging your iPhone to call in during the question segment, and you're driving to the supermarket, there's some part of you, especially if you're listening to us or listening to NPR in the afternoon the way I would be if I weren't on the show right now, you're feeling slightly guilty. It's like, why am I doing this? I know it's bad. Shouldn't I be walking? And shouldn't I have gotten a friend to read something into my ear as opposed to using radio, which burns electricity, which creates global warming? It's important to understand that this is not something bad that everybody did. Electricity became a part of our lives with Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla. Do you guys remember the phrase killer app from the early part of the Macintosh story? So electricity, we had understood it throughout, you know, from, let's say, the 1820s on, we understood you could generate it and we could even store it. But there was no use for it. It was just like a weird party trick. So Benjamin Franklin in the previous century, he would electrify spiders. And people at dinner parties, when you sat down, you'd pick up your fork and it would have a little spark in it and you would jump back. That was all we had done with electricity. Edison had been using electricity for the telegraph, and he thought, I can put this into every home. I just need a killer app. And the killer app was the light bulb. And then suddenly we were all living electrified lives. And when that happened, the New York Times didn't say this is going to be a problem and we should lay off the sauce. what they said was that Edison and also Tesla would be great benefactors of the human race. It was meant to be a wonderful plus. What Tesla said is that no longer will men be slaves to difficult tasks. The work of the future will be the pressing of electronic buttons, which all of us now pretty much are doing. Certainly all of us in the studio are doing right now. Then it turned out that by the 1896, we understood that it was like a math problem. When you use coal to generate electricity, you release a gas, carbon dioxide, that in the future would raise temperatures. And then in the 1950s, what Roger Revelle, the guy who was talking in Time magazine, what he realized was it's not two or three centuries away, it's happening now. And then the question was finding scientists who could demonstrate that it was happening. And that took 60 years. But now all of us feel guilty that we are using electricity, that we're failing a moral test. And it's not a moral test. It's just something that happened. We thought it was a useful product. It's been tremendously useful. It has raised the standard of living worldwide. And now we have this technological problem to solve that we sometimes mistake for a moral problem.
And, you know, I do want to return to that whole discussion about the personal responsibility narrative here. But I want to I'm going to read an email from Rob, which is related to the next part of your book. Rob writes, "Most of the world accepts that climate change is real and caused by human activity. Even conservatives in other countries like Great Britain accept this. I'm curious as why we in America cannot come to this conclusion, but I suspect it has a lot to do with social media and the efforts of others to sow doubt to American people. I'm greatly saddened this critically important issue has been turned into political football." Rob, thank you for that, because it is related to what I wanted to ask David next. Rob is thinking about social media, but this denialism, this group of people who sow doubt came long before social media was a thing, before the internet was a thing. And they are related, I learned in your book, to those who try to postpone our realization that cigarettes cause cancer.
That's so funny. It was a little bit like, Jennifer, it was like being in a car and seeing something cool in the distance and wanting to talk about it. And then the car speeds up and you make a turn and there's something else that you have to comment on. Let me just go back to, yes, the tobacco thing was a wild punchline. You're doing your research and then you're like, holy God. And you both tear your hair out and then you smile because you know you have a great story to tell. But Rob, sometimes, again, there was a great thing, Susan Sontag, since we're talking about great intellectual figures from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and today. Susan Sontag wrote a great thing about cancer, and the essay is called Illness is a Metaphor. And we've come to use climate and denial as a metaphor. And so, Rob, there's a lot of stuff that's wrong with America, especially during election season. We have to confront it. But no, denial has crept back in among all our European partners. In fact, they were ahead of us in accepting climate change or global warming by the mid-90s. But doubt has been sowed all across Europe, too. And Germany, as you guys know, probably announced that it was going back to using coal as of about 2 years ago. And of course, in China, I believe they are building a new coal-fired electrical plant every 3 to 4 days. So the reason why denial on this issue has been popular is to accept it means that the cushy way that we have lived for 150 years is complicated, and it may need some adjustment if there isn't a great third act technological fix. So that part done, Rob, you can smile in a different way and just think not that the American human species is bad, but that the worldwide human species doesn't like to believe things that cause us to live in a less pleasant way. So tobacco, facing the same problems that we all are facing with electricity, is great, and flying places is great, but at the moment it causes a kind of temperature pollution. Tobacco made huge amounts of money from cigarettes, astonishing amounts of money. I think by mid-century there was something like 10 billion cigarettes consumed a year, maybe more. Like just that figure, if you visualize just 10 billion cigarettes. I think the average American was smoking 11 cigarettes a day. So that's for every American woman, man, boy, girl. And then in the late 40s, they discovered that their product was causally related to cancer. And then in the 50s, it took about 10 years for science to catch on. In the 50s, scientists said, hey, your product is causally related to cancer. And I see we're coming towards our break. The tobacco companies were faced with a serious problem, which is, do you welcome the research or do you fight it? And here's the beauty of American ingenuity, in this case, expressed kind of badly in sort of mustache twirling terms. The tobacco company owners thought, we're just going to fight the science and say those guys are crazy. And they hired the greatest public affairs specialist of that period, a man named John Hill. You will recognize his name from the worldwide public affairs company, Hill & Knowlton. And he said, geez, no, don't say science is crazy. We are a scientific country. The product of science, the atomic bomb, just ended a war early for us 10 years ago. Don't say you want less research. People will know you're lying. Here's the beauty part. Say you want to make sure. Say you want more research. And that way you can say, you can keep stalling. So for example, let's say in your family, someone says, we need to buy a new car this year. If you say no, everyone else in the family gets mad at you. But if you say, let's study all the car makes, let's look into loans, let's decide what the best car is, let's everyone ask all your friends, it's going to take a year or two and maybe everyone will forget or something else will happen. And that is the strategy that they pioneered. And then they pioneered a second strategy, which is, don't fight science. Find celebrity scientists who you can pay to say untrue things.
So much there. And I want to come back to this analogy with cigarettes and the reality that some of the very same actors were the same people talking about in both parts of our recent history. But I do need to take a break, as you mentioned, David. Our phone number here on Maine Calling, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, the history of climate change and climate denial. My guest today, David Lipsky. He writes fiction and nonfiction, is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. We are talking about his latest book, The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. You can join the conversation with an email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. David, I want to talk just a little bit more about what we were talking about earlier, which was how this seed of skepticism was really sowed during the discussion, the early discussions about whether cigarettes cause cancer, and how a lot of the tactics have been used we're talking about climate today, but in many other ways. But I'm thinking about the one thing that's really, really different is when somebody finds out, or when people find out that cigarettes cause cancer, they can quit cigarettes. But when people find out that the electricity we use contributes to global warming, it's a lot harder to quit electricity. And I'm wondering if, even if we knew earlier, even if these nefarious, as you say, forces were not at work, and we did not have such a delay in our understanding of climate science collectively, do you think we still would have fixed it?
I think that's an excellent question. One of the fascinating, and this is that Elizabeth Hardwick revenge and money reasons to write books. President Carter was told in no uncertain terms by the National Academy of the Sciences, this is going to happen. It's going to start happening in the 90s. And we didn't take action. One of the things that I think has been fascinating about this, I think even using phrases like the science or using phrases like denial is a word that's freighted. The reason it was picked for this by very smart rhetoricians is that we know you aren't supposed to deny a specific awful thing that happened, a specific historical fact. And then the idea is to take some of that moral gravity and apply it to this issue. My sense is no. And that's been an interesting thing to talk about with climate scientists, too. The denial movement was basically dead by the middle of the last decade. You notice you don't see denial celebrities on CNN or MSNBC or even Fox anymore. There aren't people who speak up for the other side. There are politicians who say they don't want to do it, but there aren't those Darth Vader type scientists. And so the interesting thing that we have to face, let's say since 2015, 2017, again, there was a denial in office, a denier in office, but is that we have decided as a whole, as a society, planetarily, that the deal is so good from fossil fuel-based electricity and fossil fuel-based gasoline and whatever airplane fuel is called, that we're going to keep doing it and just hope we get a fix in the third act, or hope on some level that maybe it's not true, or that some extra terrible heat from June on isn't going to be that bad. Now, the scientists who told us about the problem do tell us it's going to be that bad, but we're kind of walking into a very dark, semi-haunted house without a candle and without a torch.
We're going to go to Mark, who's calling from Vienna. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Thank you. I wonder what we can learn from the COVID crisis that would apply to the climate crisis, like spreading misinformation versus following science, projecting blame with disparaging nicknames versus building teamwork, maintaining our status quo versus fast-tracking technology like vaccines or alternative energy, stoking fear and anger versus thoughtful problem solving, seeing interactions at the global level between global warming, agricultural crisis, inflation in food prices, and immigration, and finally being able to balance rights, responsibilities, and privileges for our common good. Thank you.
I just thought that was beautiful and wish we could make it into a new climate anthem. So let's just pause and appreciate what Mark, I assume you jotted that down. That can't have been off the top of your head. If not, you should be on this show and Jennifer and I should be in the audience because that was very beautiful. Yeah, I looked at it's interesting talking about this also with people who've written about climate and who are climate scientists. And they look at what happened with COVID differently, which is a lot of times the people who are green campaigners, campaigner is the British word for people who commit to a single topic, like she's a campaigner for climate or she's a campaigner for trans rights. They often say you have to take baby steps. So one of the heartbreaking moments in the story is by 2007, and by the story, I mean our history of facing up to this sort of temperature pollution that this wonderful part of our lives produces. One of the wild moments of the story is February of 2007. It's proven to everybody's satisfaction. Even the Bush White House says, we accept this report that human beings without question are changing the climate. So even the most science hostile administration of recent times, the second Bush administration, embraced the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's results that said unequivocally, humans now change the climate with fossil fuels. Tremendous momentum. Al Gore and the UN IPCC share the Nobel Prize. And what we set out to ban was the light bulb, which would have been the worst possible thing to do with that momentum. It would be like winning the lotto and then spending it all on athletic socks. It's like athletic socks are good, but they're really not going to be life-changing. So the idea when I was talking to people who are green campaigners, they said you can't ask Americans to do too much or they'll walk away. They will just throw their hands up. And so the fascinating thing was to watch COVID, Mark, which is with very little time to prepare, 2 weeks notice, 1 week notice, we were told to radically change our style of life. And we were told to change it both for ourselves and also for the common good. And people bellyached and they complained and they did share misinformation, but everybody did it and they did it for more than a year. And to me, that was thrilling to watch because it matched what I know about people and especially about Americans, which is if you ask us something and you tell us the reason, we'll do it.
Yeah. Mark, thanks so much for your interesting call. If you want to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. I want to talk a little bit, David, about the narrative of personal responsibility, this idea that we all are responsible for climate change. And I know that many of our listeners drive electric cars or hybrid cars, compost, recycle, try to do so many things. And this idea of personal responsibility, there's a story behind this as well, isn't there? This narrative that oh, it's not the government's job. It's your own personal job.
Jennifer, you really know this book. So you are asking me to tell the story of Keep America Beautiful. Do you guys and anyone out there and Jennifer and Sandra, our wonderful engineer, do you guys know the story? Now, this was an ad. This is the most popular public affair, the most popular public service ad ever aired. And I'm going to use its name. It's referred to as the Crying Indian ad. Do you guys remember it?
Yes, I'm old enough to remember that.
Yeah. But it is the most widely seen ad, I think, in history. And during the course of the ad, someone cries, and media historians refer to it as the most famous visibly shed tear in history. I think it's been seen now something like 10 billion times. Second time I've used 10 billion in this hour. What happens is an Indian is a Native American, again, Indian called in the ad. A Native American is paddling a canoe and he beaches the canoe. And then the next cut is he's standing near a terrible superhighway at like 16 lanes in both directions. And as if that's not bad enough, the awful sound and the sadness of seeing all these lives go by that have no connection to yours, literally soul crushing. Someone throws a giant bag of fast food garbage out the window and it lands at the Native American's feet. It lands on his moccasins, napkins and straws spill out. And then the camera goes in tight on his face and a single tear glides out of his left eye and goes down his cheek. And the voiceover comes on. It was a voiceover man named William Conrad, who was the second deepest voice in America at that time. The first deepest was James Earl Jones, of course, Darth Vader. So ha had James Earl Jones had laryngitis, I think William Conrad would have been the voice of Darth Vader. And he says, people start pollution, people can stop it. Now, it motivated a whole generation of kids to become litter watchers, to pick up after their parents, and that was great. But within a few years, green campaigners, the green groups, pointed out that the sponsors of that ad were not fellow green groups, but it was a consortium of bottle manufacturers. It was Pepsi Cola and Coca-Cola and Reynolds Aluminum and American Can. And what the ad was really for was to stop recycling. They thought recycling would cost them a few quarter pennies per unit. And think of the slogan. Not government should co not governments should stop pollution, not corporations that stop pollution, but people cause pollution and people should stop it. And the sad thing for me, and one of the funny parts of this story is 1975, the groups like the NRDC step in and say, this is a decoy, it's a fake, don't believe it, government has to handle this. And now we have found so few ways to combat global warming that now green groups will welcome that and they will say, yes, you should do what you can to stop global warming. In that same year, when we decided to ban the light bulb, Al Gore, who was sharing the Nobel Prize and who also had won another even larger prize that year, he'd won the Academy Award for his documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. What he said is, it's not about changing light bulbs, it's about changing our laws and changing our leaders. But in the absence of any real action, it has fallen on us to try to make that change. And I think it's an unfair thing.
We'll go to Shane calling from Westbrook. Hi, Shane, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm old enough to remember the 1975 predictions, what you segued right into my question. When research was showing that an ice age was impending, and just curious how that changed so quickly in the last 40 or so years.
One of the things that's a fascinating thing, Shane, it's a great question. And it's one of the great ironies of this issue. We saw the Earth begin to heat up around the turn of the previous century. And so by the 1930s, cover of the New York Times headline is America in warmest spell in its history. And on the left, this is an above the fold story. On the left, there's a story saying we have to close down Al Capone's speakeasies. And on the right, there's a story, Nazis promised to end attacks on Jews in the Reich. So between Al Capone and the Nazis, we have a headline front page story in the New York Times about climate change. The funny thing is that we were polluting so much, especially a silicate matter called sulfur dioxide, which tends to reflect the sun's light back off the planet. The Earth became so polluted by about 1950, 1960, that it was retarding global warming. So that when clean air laws began to take effect in the later 70s, As we clean the air up, then global warming began to set in more powerfully. But yes, we had so polluted the air. And if you look at, there's a great book to read about this, Sean. It's called The Weather Machine by Nigel Calder. I believe it came out in 71 or 72. The planet had become so dirty, the air had become so dirty that it looked like we were going in the other direction, that we were cooling the planet. And we were cooling the planet, but via pollution. And the last thing about that, Shane, which is totally fascinating, is if you search the phrase geoengineering and sulfur dioxide, it was so effective that our emergency parachute, if global warming gets really bad, is to spend about $20 billion and have a fleet of jetliners dump sulfur dioxide into the air, and that would cool us down by about 1 degrees. Among the side effects, one of the weirdest ones is it would turn our sky white for a year.
Shane, thanks so much for your call. We'll go up to Falmouth and Maura. Hi, Maura, go ahead.
Hi, I'm glad you're having the show. Jennifer, you just said that people can quit cigarettes, but they can't quit electricity. And yes, I agree with that. But also, people can change their source of electricity. I got solar panels on my roof 2022 in October, and I haven't bought electricity since. And I'm also getting my basement insulated and getting an 80% rebate from the Efficiency Maine, which will cut my heating by 30%. So I think making these changes individually will help.
Yeah, well, yeah, Maura, I wanted to, I'm so glad you called, because as David's been talking, I've been thinking about the reality that Maine has announced that it's ahead of its climate goals, that because of the rebates and the big adoption of heat pumps and things like that in Maine, that we're doing well. And a lot of people are like Maura and have either put solar panels on their own homes, or they've joined a solar farm. So there are a lot of our listeners, David, who are taking steps and saying, wait a minute, we here in Maine are making progress. Don't be talking about doom and gloom. It is possible.
I think it's wonderful, and those things are beneficial to the environment anyway. There's a number of ways. We only have 23 minutes, and I think actually just 21 minutes left. So I'm trying to figure out the best way to express this, and burning some seconds now by talking about my indecision about which explanation to use. But here's a great one. A friend of mine who really cares about this issue went down to DC to write speeches for the senator, one of the two or three senators most closely associated with the issue, someone who says, do all that sort of work, personal actions on the part of all of us can change this. Now, people like Al Gore and Governor Jerry Brown, what they say is that is a way of stopping corporations and government from assuming their actual responsibilities and taking actions that can help everybody, is pushing it back down to people at ground level. But this friend of mine, who was a speechwriter for the senator, was shocked to find out that in his in the senator's personal life, the senator did not take those actions. And then, as he got to know that senator's friends, who are also associated with the issue, what he learned is that all of them believe that it's not going to be personal actions that make a difference. It is going to be, what they're waiting for is some kind of gadget, that they believe there will be a technological solution. And then I'm going to squeeze in the other answer, which has to do with how little we tend to know versus, for example, the people who created the vaccines that allowed us to come blinking out of our homes after COVID. America had some great news last year about its emissions record, and we haven't had terrific news. But our coal use had dropped around 2007, 2006, 51, 52% of our electricity, I'm trying to speak faster, came from coal, and coal creates the most temperature pollution. And then, as of last year, it was down to 19% nationwide for which fuel we were using to generate electricity. Only 19% of it comes from coal. Do you know what made the difference?
I'm going to guess natural gas.
Yes, fracking. So fracking is something that I would have gone out and protested, because it seemed like squirting high pressure jets of water into fissures in the earth is almost a terrible metaphor for how poor our stewardship can sometimes be of this planet that we inherited. But in fact, it has been the best thing for us and global warming in the last 20, 30 years. And so that's why I do believe that the solutions to this, it's a little bit like people kept victory gardens. I think I'm the only person here who knows what a victory garden is. Sandra, Jennifer? Okay,
we know.
Sandra knows what. Okay, Victory Gardens, because the food wasn't, there was a great metonym during World War II. What's good is in the army, what's left will never harm me. Bananas, other good fruits were being shipped to GIs during World War II. So to help us attain victory, every American was encouraged to grow a small garden in their backyard or front yard. Also, we're encouraged to do scrap metal drives for a similar reason. And that's great, but that's not what defeated fascism. What defeated fascism were governments saying, hey, we're going to change the way we're living for a certain amount of time, and we're going to devote all our resources to solving this problem. It is good if people take individual action, but national problems tend to be resolved by national solutions.
Maura, thank you so much for calling in. We do have to take another quick break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, we're talking about climate change and anti-science attitudes. Joining me today, David Lipsky, who is the author of The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial, that is now out in paperback. We have lots of calls standing by, but if you want to try to join them, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to John, who's calling from Damariscotta. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I think one of the things that the climate change proponents need to do is to provide simple, undeniable proof that humans are causing climate change, because, of course, climate change has always been happening on Earth. Why is it that this time it's human caused? As you know, 15,000 years ago, was between a mile and 2 miles of ice above Maine, and that all melted because of what was a change in climate. And the other thing that needs to be proven before people, you know, kind of jump in whole hog and change their lives and change the economy of the country and the world is can windmills, EVs, solar panels actually do something about it?
John, thank you so much for calling. And David, I think John is, his views reflect a lot of people's views.
I was checking the time. John, you've defeated me, and I have no answer to your brilliant points. So I'd like to retire. I'm teasing. John, it's a great question. I could tell from the order of the question that what you're really saying, and it is the response of many Americans, and it is worth everybody paying attention to, which is one doesn't want to make those changes. And that's the basic point. And then your lead off is maybe it's not true. So on the maybe it's not true point, and then there was a second point that you made, which is climate has always changed. Scientists have been studying this for more than a century. Basic way to, you don't really know that that vaccine would cure COVID. You don't know that internal combustion actually makes you could not easily break down all the steps in a Tesla that allow digitally the car to know that you have turned the wheel to the right, and that since it's no longer an analog machine, it tells the wheels to turn fractionally to the right as you're driving, but you accept that the car will do that. And so at a certain basis, you do accept science when even people who don't want to believe the science will trust it. The basic thing on that is the Bush White House, which could not have fought it harder. The Bush White House, second one, was like the Rocky in this. They fought it as long and hard. They went the distance. If going the distance was 15 rounds against climate change, they went 45 rounds, 60 rounds, 75 rounds. And then as the evidence came in, they said, yes, we accept this too. Second thing is, and it's a common thing that people say, climate is always changing. And one way to think about that is it would be like, if someone said, hey, you shouldn't smoke because it will make your organs break down, you could then say, yes, our bodies break down from the time that we are born and we are going to die. The Bible says we have 70. So since we're dying anyway, you know, why does it matter? How can we demonstrate that it's cigarettes that are accelerating the process as opposed to just general decay? It is, yes, climate changes, which is something that we ought to be careful about. And then we can affect this kind of change by producing more carbon dioxide. A simple proof of that, John, if you look up Mount Pinatubo and a scientist named James Hansen, essentially Mount Pinatubo cooling the earth down with sulfur dioxide and then the temperature then going back to the rate of increase that Professor Hansen had suggested is seen as one of the early proofs. And Professor Hansen saying in Newsweek that this giant volcano from 91 was going to cool the earth down, 94 rather, forgive me, that is often seen as being a nice bit of, hey, believe this, it's going on. And then the last part, which is, are these things a benefit? Fracking turned out to be a benefit. And interestingly, the Chinese have come up with solar panels that are extremely cost effective. Part of the idea about, and this is one of the things that the Biden White House has done, they released about $1 trillion. It will not released all at once, but to, you know, wonderful corporations that want to develop both strategies and products that can create energy in ways that are less temperature polluting. The idea is that once you have companies working on it, you get better versions of the products, so that if you don't invest, then you don't get solar panels that are effective. But as there's a market, people find cheaper and better ways to do it. John, a good way to think about it would be to compare the Apple II from 1978 with whatever iPhone you have in your pocket, which is an Apple computer, which you can now watch TV on and talk to people face to face with as if you were Dick Tracy. So when there is a capital incentive to do something, we tend to get more and more effective things for all of us to use.
John, thank you so much for your call. One thing I want to ask you, David, your book came out a year ago. Now it's in paperback. A lot of things have happened in that year. A lot of really terrible wildfires, other weather events. How much of a difference does that make?
It's super interesting. So, I know there are other callers in the queue, but basically climate scientists, there was a climate scientist who won the Nobel Prize in the mid-90s, a man named Sherwood Rowland, and he asked the key question, which is, what's the point of having developed a science well enough to make predictions if in the end all we're willing to do is stand around and wait for the predictions to come true? And then kind of wonderfully, about 20 years later, Professor Hansen, when he was retiring from NASA, what he said was, it's as if we didn't know. We might as well not know. Our energy use wouldn't be any different. And that kind of, that pessimism is one of the really interesting things that's been sad and sort of fascinating to watch in climate scientists. Do you guys remember the ozone crisis from the 80s?
Yes.
We were using products that ate, the ozone is just the planet's sunblock, and we were using products that ate away that sunblock. And there was the exact same denial fight. How do you know? How do you prove it? It's just scientists. And then after about 10 years of the fight, it turned out there was a giant hole in our ozone layer. It was larger than the continent of Antarctica, and it could be seen from Mars. And then within 2 years, there were international binding agreements that phased out CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, which are what were causing the ozone hole. The climate scientists had been waiting for decades for there to be a moment like that with global warming. And what they thought were the wildfires and the summers that we've been having for the last 2 or 3 years, that would finally convince, you know, intelligently skeptical people like John, and then encourage them to ask for action. And it was interesting talking to some of them during the last year. It didn't have that effect. So what they understand pretty much is that at the moment, the wonderful benefits of fossil-based fuels, we accept that there's a risk. We just don't say out loud. We've decided to accept the risk and see what happens.
We'll go to David calling from Westbrook. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hello. Well, from one David to another, I'm bothered by the intergenerational immorality of climate denial. And it seems like we are oblivious to the harms that will come to our children and grandchildren. Most of us Americans have children and grandchildren, and we will take steps to protect them, to make them safe. From a lot less threats than climate change. So, David, I wonder in your research or thinking, have you come across reasons why we've ignored this or seem to ignore this?
From another David back to the initial David, it's great to hear your David sounding voice. There's a great moment. I don't know if you could hear on the over the radio that I was smiling. There's a wonderful moment that I saw that was on video. The video was taken down. It was at the Clinton Foundation used to have global summits, basically. And there was a summit with the head of Timberland, the sustainability officer from Walmart, and then a scientist from the Nature Conservancy. And he had that smirk of somebody. It's like the smirk of somebody who's been through three or four divorces, and he's hearing an optimistic couple talking about going into relationship counseling. And the fellow from Walmart keeps saying, we have to protect our grandchildren. We all care about our grandchildren. And finally, after having this slightly wizened smile, this veteran smile, the scientist from the Nature Conservancy spoke up, and he said, you know, what I've learned from this for over the last 10 or 15 years is that we don't care about our grandchildren that much. We've never met them. You know, we're not going to spend that much time with them, because people use that as a metaphor all the time, but it doesn't change behaviors really. And I would also argue, there's an intergenerational response to climate that goes in both directions. And generally, to be a young person, for those of us who are around my age, we were really angry at the older generation for having destroyed America by creating an incredible debt problem, which persists to this day. And I think what that sometimes also expresses is just generational rivalry. Often what you're upset with is that an older generation occupies spots or houses that you would like to occupy. And then a way to phrase that is by saying, look at the mess you left us. And the reality is, any rivalry on this, you didn't, David, one David to another, you didn't make a corrupt moral choice to drive to work or use electricity. That was the world that was presented to you. That is the society we were born into. And to the degree that there's blame about it, it actually stops us from getting together and solving the problem. And solving the solution is going to come technologically from industry, or it's going to come from government. The people who are leading the fight, they understand that that's where it's going to come from. And I think the squabbling has actually stopped us from getting together. In a sense, that kind of squabbling tends to benefit denial.
David, thanks for your call and an email.
I appreciate
that's
related. That's so nice of you to thank me as a David.
This is an email from Tom. I see the biggest issue with climate denial on the right is the perception of government. If one takes the position that big government is intrusive on our freedom and the federal government is incompetent in addressing an issue like climate change, which requires not only strong federal government response, but a global government response, does not fit with your preconceived notion of what governments can and cannot do and should or should not do, because the exigency of climate change requires a coordinated and global and national solution. If you believe that it is impossible, you must deny it.
That was really beautiful. Forgive me, am I called upon to respond? There's almost nothing to add to that. Forgive me, the name of the emailer, I was so taken with his,
Tom.
Tom, what I thought of when I was hearing your email, it's as if you and I were exchanging thoughts telepathically. Generally, the way we solve problems in this country is as a group, and to the degree that we're asked to do it individually, it is a way of distracting us from the problem. Do you guys know what the highest marginal tax rate was, let's say, by 1961 in America?
90%.
And the reason why, I've always loved it. I was watching the first version of the movie The Thing from 1951, and you could tell the confidence that the people in uniform had of their ability to solve problems. The reason for that has always seemed to me, rich people had not figured out a way to resist Nazi aggression, fascist aggression. The only way that could have been done was if the mass of people in America and all over the world, if they linked arms and said no. And then when they came back, they said, look, you are richer than us, but it is our country. And we just fought for and won our country in a way. We won it from a fascist threat. And so we're going to tax you the way we kind of want, because it is kind of our country. I've always loved that spirit. When people talk about when America, I mean, there's that phrase, make America great. And they're often, I believe, thinking about that weird sort of half eyeglass early NASA period. And that was the confidence we had, which is we can solve problems together, but they do have to be national solutions. So yeah, absolutely, Tom, that was beautiful.
Just a few seconds. It kind of sounds, David, like you might be an optimist a little bit.
Yeah, I got extremely optimistic, A, about COVID, but B, the fracking. Everybody has believed there could be technological solutions. They're just embarrassed about it because we do tend to have a wasteful society. And so a lot of people saw that this would be a way to address that. But fracking, that combination of things, and especially the idea that there could be, A, that Americans would sacrifice if called upon, and B, there could be technological aids. Yeah, I have become very optimistic.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for your time. That's David Lipsky. The book is The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. David is also a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and has written other books as well. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris, Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.